Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. This is Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, as we mentioned, this is going to be the first of a two-part kind of mini-series look at a very critical organization that's been serving our listening area since 1914. I'm talking about what was the Ridgefield Visiting Nurse Association, now known as RVNA Health. They're a private nonprofit, mission-driven organization founded and focused on care. While their name and services have evolved since their founding way back in 1914, their principles have remained steadfast to serve exceptional patient care and provide a great commitment to excellence in quality and service. One of the many who serve the organization and folks like you is Melissa Woodhouse. She's the director of Stay Well Services for RVNA Health, and we're going to meet her in just a moment. But hey, one of the things that comes along with maintaining good health is hopefully maintaining good health coverage. And unfortunately, as we're seeing and hearing, that coverage for many of us is going to get much more costly. So our partners over at the Connecticut Insurance Department are holding a hybrid informational meeting at 9 a.m. on August 20th on the health insurance rate request filings for the 2025 individual and small group on exchange and off exchange plans. So if your health plan falls into any of those categories, you're probably going to be facing a rate increase, but the Connecticut Insurance Department wants you to know more about it. Access Health CT is the state's health insurance exchange, and there are 8 filings made by 7 health insurers for plans that currently cover almost 200,000 people. So if you'd like to take part in this or offer testimony, you can join virtually via Zoom by emailing your full name to cid.ratefilings@ct.gov. Or you can just submit written testimony and tell your story or make your appeal regarding the rate increases. You just need to do that by 5 p.m. on the day of this info session, August 20th. And you can also do that by email by going to cid.ratefilings@ct.gov. So with that said, let's flip back to our friend Melissa to talk about RVNA. Hey, Melissa, how you doing?
Good. Thank you for having me on. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. So let's hear a little bit about your story. Tell us a little bit about your background and what brought you to RVNA.
Sure. So I am actually duly licensed as a respiratory therapist and an occupational therapist. And I came to RVNA Health as an occupational therapist working in home care with people who had, you know, multiple diseases and needs that required an occupational therapist to come in and help them in their home.
So what is Stay Well Services that you are representing?
Yep. So I now am the director for the private pay division of the agency. So this is where someone might need a caregiver to come into their home anywhere from 4 hours to 24 hours a day to help them with their day-to-day tasks and maybe even go out for them if they need to run any errands, as well as private duty nursing and geriatric care management.
So how long have you been with RVNA?
For over 10 years.
Oh, that's great. So over the time you have been with the organization, what are a few of the services that you've seen that have really found a great popularity in the geographic area of the state that you guys cover?
No, that's a great question. And we cover over 35 towns now, and we're based out of Ridgefield and New Milford. So we have a wide range. Really, the services that we provide are for anything unrelated to the hospital, right? Like we take care of people in their homes. If they've had a recent injury or illness or diagnoses, and they just don't know how to navigate it, but they're at home and Maybe they just got out of the hospital with a new diagnosis of some sort. We have home health services. So this is completely covered by insurance, needs a doctor's order, and a nurse, physical therapist, occupational therapist, speech therapist, and even a home health aide can come out and help the person get back up on their feet. We have hospice services now, which has been hugely helpful to allow people to remain comfortably in their home at the end stage of their life. We also have outpatient physical therapy, occupational therapy, and speech therapy, where someone can come into our building in Ridgefield and get those services in our clinic. We have community health and wellness, which is a whole host of different services from prenatal care to vaccines. We do clinics to help kids who need physicals to get back to school. There's just many, many, many different things that
Well, you brought up a couple of really important points. The first of which is that while we're still here in the month of August, we're barreling toward October, where we try to promote saying boo to the flu by getting your flu shot. And I know RVNA, I think I have had RVNA nurses putting flu shots into my own arm over the past 20 years when I'm on my other job over in the Newtown area. So let's start by reminding people not just flu vaccines, but also there's going to be another round of COVID-19 vaccines that are due to hit the market and patients' arms in the coming weeks. These are really, really vital services. And I imagine you guys really distribute thousands and thousands of these vaccines every year.
Yes, we do. We hold clinics. And, you know, even if somebody has a question, like they've had something life-changing happen to them and they don't know how to navigate it, they can call into the agency, they can walk in, and one of us will go and talk to them and help every step of the way.
The other key point that you made briefly was, I think when a lot of people hear VNA, unless they've experienced it themselves, they think, oh, another service for our aging population. But you pointed out prenatal care, and you pointed out child wellness services and child clinics. You guys cover before birth to to hospice and aging, and even the select centenarians, the centenarians that you you have in your circle.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've done a really good job over the years of creating just one place for people to come, and we can navigate them through all the different stages of their life, no matter what happens to them, which is really nice. You don't have to go to multiple different places. You just come to us.
And as I pointed out from the flu clinics, you guys have branched out into the critically important component of essentially a kind of a roving public health agency. Public health and safety is another area that you guys really focus on.
Absolutely. Yeah, we also have multiple seminars and different webinars that people can call into to get information about fall prevention, how to fall safely, osteoporosis. I mean, the list is extensive, and they could go onto our website and take a look and see all the different, you know, opportunities that they have. We also have a Parkinson's center now too, so we can help navigate if somebody has early Parkinson's or late stages of Parkinson's. There's different classes they can take too, all for free. So it's a good opportunity to take a look at our website to see what we have available.
Yeah. Well, let's return to the areas that you're most familiar with. Tell us about you and your team handling the various specific therapies that you're trained in.
Sure. So really, our department handles anything insurance won't cover. So let's say, you know, somebody was just diagnosed with a stroke and now they're going to go home and they're alone and they're scared and they need help with everything. They can call us up and they can get a caregiver to help them, you know, with the day-to-day activities that maybe are now difficult to them, like taking a shower or making a meal for themselves. So unfortunately, you know, insurance doesn't cover a ton. And if they need somebody to stay with them in their house for anywhere from 4 hours to 24 hours, they can give us a call and we can supply them with a caregiver, a nurse, or even a geriatric care manager who could help navigate through any nuances like a disease or getting older can, you know, inflict upon a family and that person themselves.
So you have obviously, as you mentioned, a private payer, but you're also involved like people who may be on Medicare or Medicaid or yep. Have their own insurance. You folks are also serving those qualified patients as well.
Absolutely. So that would be through our home health department, if depending on what the need is, or hospice, of course. And all those services are covered completely by insurance.
Great. In terms of the ways that your staff gets out there in the public eye, to not only to remind them about RVNA Health, but also to help benefit their health and well-being, what are a couple of the activities that maybe you've been involved in, or you know that other elements of your team are involved in, that you think really go above and beyond to make sure that all the folks in the many communities that you serve are in the best possible health?
Yeah, as I mentioned, you know, we have lots of different presentations that we give that can help prepare somebody for what's next in their life. I know I just gave a talk about, you know, how to do a home modification to your home so you can stay in your home long-term. People want to stay home. It's cheaper to stay home. So those presentations I think are hugely helpful. We also had a huge dementia series just recently too. We have two instructors specifically who know dementia and how to train caregivers on it. And that was a huge hit. I think that it was eye-opening for a lot of people and also helped them prepare for the future. But I think in general, our agency really knows how to help people navigate through all, like I mentioned, the stages of their life and whatever that brings in, you know, like if they have an illness or a fall. You know, some people, they come to us and they're very scared and they don't know what to do. And so we're able to coordinate all that for them, talk to their doctors, talk to their family members. And I think that that really does help. But we also have a whole part of the agency that helps with prevention as well.
Excellent. Well, we're looking forward to talking to another one of your colleagues in the second segment of this small series that we're doing, providing some education and exposure to an organization that's been serving Southwestern Connecticut for 110 years. Talking about what was the Ridgefield Visiting Nurse Association and now is known as RVNA Health. That is their website, rvnahealth.org, a private nonprofit organization providing exceptional home and community healthcare services, supporting public health and safety, and promoting the highest quality of life now across 35 towns in our region. So we want to thank you, Melissa Woodhouse. She is the director of their Stay Well services, and we will be back with RVNA. Stay tuned for part two coming up in a week or so. Thank you, Melissa. All right. Well, we have reached the midpoint in the program, and it's a great time to refocus not only on the Greater Naugatuck Valley and one of its greatest environmental assets, but also to get reacquainted with a voice that has been absent for way too far long on here with the award-winning For the People. I'm talking about my longtime acquaintance, Rick Dunn. He is the executive director of the Naugatuck Valley Council of Governments. Rick, I dare say you've probably been on the radio with me over the years, 6, 8, 10 times. It's fantastic to have you back, and I'm sorry it's taken so long, but you've brought along a new friend, I hope, Aaron Budris. He's the Environmental Planning Director for the Naugatuck Valley Council of Governments, and we're here today to not only remind you what the Naugatuck Valley Council of Governments does in terms of its wide range of programs and services, but mostly to call you to show up. because on Wednesday, August 28th, beginning at 6 p.m., there's going to be a Kinneytown Dam Removal Community Meeting at the Ansonia Senior Center right on Main Street in Ansonia. They want to hear from you down at the Naugatuck Valley COG. They want you to bring your questions about the Kinneytown Dam and its removal project. This is the first public community meeting. There'll be a film screening, a discussion around the benefits of the dam removal, and more. Child care is going to be provided. Refreshments will be provided. And all you need to do is go to tinyurl.com/Kinneytown Meeting to get registered. So Rick and Aaron, thank you for joining us. Rick, let's connect with you first. Beyond the introduction, tell me a little bit more about how you've been, what you've been doing, and what folks across our entire listening area need to know about the Naugatuck Valley COG and how you fit in a patchwork of Council of Governments across the state.
Sure. Well, thanks for having us on, John. I appreciate it. You're right. It's been quite a while, but happy to be here today with Aaron to talk about this really important project. So, you know, the Council of Governments is an organization that's a, you know, we're a metropolitan planning organization, also a Council of Governments, which represents the 19 towns in the area, ranging from Shelton up to Southbury, up to Thomaston, across to Plymouth, out to Bristol, back down to Cheshire, and then back to Ansonia. So that whole area with Waterbury at the center is the heart of our region. We have larger geographies that we work across, having to do with environmental issues, brownfields issues. We host the Brownfields Land Bank, Connecticut Brownfields Land Bank, which covers the entire state. So, you know, we do a wide variety of things. We're very focused, obviously, on transportation planning as the federal metropolitan planning organization designated for the region. We program those dollars, your federal highway funds, into transit, into rail, buses, and obviously highways. We have a strong community planning division. We now assist all of our towns with all of the current housing needs and compliance issues that they have in planning for housing and having appropriate workforce housing. In Naugatuck Valley, one of the things we really focus on is planning for transit-oriented development, taking advantage of not just the river, but the rail line and that entire Route 8 corridor that runs up the spine. So that's sort of the connective tissue for us and really trying to bring back these 19th century transit communities into the 21st century. You know, we're well positioned for that. Yeah. And so as we create more housing along these corridors, as we create better transit connections, particularly with the rail, we want to restore access to the river. Those communities historically built industrial centers with their backs to the river, basically using the river as a sewer. And, we have an opportunity now to bring people closer to the river, back to that. Aaron heads up the Naugatuck River Greenway program, which is we started back in 96 at the old Valley COG, and with the segment in Derby and the segment in Shelton. And we have continued to grow that with the vision of creating a 48-mile greenway from Derby up to Torrington and potentially into Winchester as well. So we work on a range of fronts. Brownfields remediation, again, a big piece of what we do, trying to restore either industrial base or convert that land to a more natural use in many cases. If we can't rebuild industrial capacity, what we want to do is we want to create housing. We want to create access back to the river. We're
getting people on it no matter what, because if it's a brownfield, right, it's dangerous in some cases to even walk near it or through it. But getting right, it to a position where people can even access the parcel again is mission critical.
Right. And so, I mean, we do a bunch of things, economic development. We work on energy issues. We work on clean water issues. But this particular project, some of my colleagues thought we were crazy, but we needed to do this with the Naugatuck River. The Naugatuck River has rebounded in ways that are just amazing. If you grew up here like we did and saw the river in the condition it was in you know, prior to the 1980s, it was still a sewer. It was an industrial sewer. And, you know, it's still a Class B river. It's still not in compliance with federal water quality attainment standards, but it's on its way. And, you know, we're in a good position here. The state has invested a fair amount of money in dam removals above Kinneytown. And the towns have invested more than $350 million in clean water improvements. So to us, removing the Kinneytown Dam is the culmination of opening up this river and potentially bringing it into attainment for with clean water standards, both the Naugatuck and potentially the lower Housatonic below Derby, where it meets up. So, and I really need to pitch for our partners on this. We partnered with Save the Sound. They are the preeminent advocate for Long Island Sound. And that includes obviously all the rivers and tributaries that feed into it. They are our partners in this project. And their team, along with our communications team, will be running the public information meetings and the other community engagement activities. But Aaron is really the lead staffer on this as the environmental planning director for the agency. Kinneytown is probably his highest profile project at the moment, and one that's going to take some time to work through.
Yeah, very good. Well, as someone who grew up in Waterbury in the 60s and 70s, I know the only people that would ever go into the river were going into a water body that didn't look like water. It looked like some sort of, colored glue more than a river itself. It certainly didn't have clear running water, and they typically were going into the water to drag out big pieces of industrial waste or cars or garbage or trash. And to be able to drive from Waterbury south through Naugatuck, Beacon Falls into Seymour, to see the guys out there in their hip boots, to be able to almost see the bottom of the river from the highway and see them out there casting their trout flies and fishing and kayaking, guys and girls and kids enjoying recreational opportunities on the river, is a tribute in great part to the work of Save the Sound and the Naugatuck Valley Cog and the Valley Cog ahead of it. So we really appreciate the work that you have done. I appreciate the work that all of the folks that have done that have played a role in making it happen. So let's give you a break, Rick, and switch gears to Aaron. So Aaron, as you're sort of looking at the history of what has brought us to this point where we're poised to remove the Kinneytown Dam, did the problem really start with the concept of the Kinneytown Dam in the first place? Was it something that was necessary to be installed at the historical point in time when it was done, and no thought was given to the environmental impact it might wreak 10, 50, 100 years down the road?
Yeah, and I mean, you even have to go farther back than that. As Rick alluded to, this was the Naugatuck River was an industrial river. You know, the early settlers here use it to run their mills and later on, industrial efforts, they've dammed the river all over the place and used the water to power their equipment. The Kinneytown Dam location, there's been a dam there since at least 1850, when there was a diversion dam that was built to feed the mills and factories in downtown Ansonia. So Kinneytown Dam was built in a series of canals and reservoirs all the way down from Seymour all the way into Ansonia to feed those factories. The dam really did serve a purpose early on. And later they added electrical generation to it, first down in Ansonia to power the brass mills there. And then in the 80s, there was power generation added in Seymour right at the dam. And when they did that, they had to get permission from the federal government, from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission that oversees power generating facilities. And as part of that permit to operate, they had to, you know, run those two powerhouses that were at the facility, and also when called upon to provide fish passage past the dam. So, you know, in 2014, when upstream, about two miles upstream from Kinneytown, a fish passage facility was built at the Tinue Dam right in downtown in Seymour. You know, we sort of thought that, you know, fish were going to be able to make it up the rest of the Naugatuck River. There had been, as Rick said earlier, there's been a lot of efforts in the 90s to remove dams in Naugatuck and Waterbury. So, you know, we thought at the time that, you know, there was fish passage all the way along the Naugatuck up to Thomason Dam. And come to find out through one community member in particular, Kevin Zach, who's been, you know, basically studying the river and looking at fish in the river for decades. You know, he sort of raised the flag at the time that, hey, you know, I don't think any fish are actually making it past Kinneytown. So, you know, we started investigating, and we sort of got to this point where, you know, we sort of better understood that, you know, Kinneytown was really a barrier to fish. Hmm. So, you know, that, you know, right now, Kinneytown Dam's not producing any energy at all. It's not going to in the future. So it really serves no purpose, but it is blocking fish. And, you know, while we got into this early on because of the fish passage issue, we've, you know, come to understand all of the other negatives that this dam is having on the river and on the communities around it.
So, okay, well, we'll jump into detailing some of those and then talk about this upcoming event. I just wanted to give you all a break for a moment to take a breath while we remind everyone about the state of Connecticut's brand new, just launched lead-free CT program, which is a new campaign overseen by the Connecticut Department of Public Health with the goal of protecting children from the harmful health impacts of lead and creating a lead-free Connecticut. A key component of the lead-free CT campaign includes the launch of a lead abatement program, which is providing homeowners and landlords with the opportunity to make older homes lead safe by removing lead paint hazards at no cost. Just be advised, this is a limited time program, so if you may be interested in having the organization check to see if you're qualified and maybe getting the funding to make it happen at your home or a property that you own, you need to apply as soon as possible simply by visiting leadfreect.org. Now we'll return to our partners over at the Naugatuck Valley Council of Governments. As we mentioned, on Wednesday, August 28th, they are calling the public to a Kinneytown Dam Removal Community Meeting beginning at 6 o'clock at Ansonia Senior Center. They want to hear from you. There'll be a film screening, a discussion around the benefits of dam removal, and more. Child care is going to be provided. Refreshments and food will be there for you. Just go to tinyurl.com/Kinneytown Meeting to get registered so they know you're coming. And they can get enough refreshments for everyone. We are with Rick Dunn, who is with the Naugatuck Valley Council of Governments, as well as Aaron Budris. He's the Environmental Planning Director for the Naugatuck Valley COG. So, Aaron, as you were explaining before our little break there, it sounds like there was a little bit of cart before the horse with the Seymour development of what, if I recall correctly, was like a kind of a fish ladder that would help the trout migrate upstream. But in fact, as a result of this key individual partner in the valley, it was determined that no trout were essentially getting upstream to Seymour because they were stopped effectively in Ansonia by the Kinneytown Dam?
Yeah, and we're really talking about, you know, migratory fish that spend, you know, a part of their lives in the open ocean and come return to spawn in rivers and tributaries. So we're talking about shad and herring, lamprey, eels. You know, you know, all of these fish right now are being prevented from accessing north of Kennytown. There was a fish ladder built at Kennytown Dam in the 1990s that, you know, was never especially effective, but, you know, sort of really relied on there being two operating power generating facilities at the dam. In the early 20-teens, one of those generating stations, the one in Ansonia, stopped working. And around 2020, the larger station at Kennytown stopped working. So, you know, the flows that used to go through these generating facilities ceased. So all of the water flow is going over the dam now. So fish are actually being attracted to the bottom of the dam instead of the fish ladder. So like I said earlier, there's, you know, there's really no benefit being provided as far as energy or anything from the dam remaining in place. But there's these serious negatives to having it there.
What are a couple of the other key negatives that are impacting both the immediate area and essentially the entire northward stretch of the Narragansett River?
So, I mean, there's impacts both upstream and downstream. You know, downstream, you know, this dam, parts of this dam are, you know, hundreds of years old. It has not been well maintained in recent years. So, you know, there is a dam safety concern, with some parts of the dam along Coe Pond. So, you know, that's one serious concern. There are, you know, health, you know, the facility itself is a health and safety concern. So parts of this facility include stretches of old canal that are no longer connected, that are stagnant, that are along North 4th Street in Ansonia. So, you know, this is basically a breeding ground for mosquitoes.
Sure.
The facility itself is old. And even though, you know, it's behind a fence, you know, it's obvious that people are entering it, and it's you know, a safety concern that way as well. And it's just, you know, it's not a very nice thing to have in people's backyards. You know, the communities all along the river, because of this facility, have been blocked from accessing the river itself. So, you know, that's another concern. And dams, you know, dams like this prevent the normal flow of sediments down a river.
Right.
So the Narragansett River is a pretty steep river. Sediments are supposed to be flowing down it and enriching the marshes along it and you know, helping attenuate flooding, coastal flood risk at the mouth of the Housatonic.
Yeah.
So all of that sediment has been prevented for, you know, hundreds of years from going downstream. So, you know, that and on top of that, water quality, you know, from sitting in the, you know, water sitting in the reservoir heats up and causes you know, thermal pollution downstream as well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's just a ton of negatives to having the dam.
Yeah,
there,
real domino effects. So this event that's coming up next week at the Ansonia Senior Center, I see as part of the announcement is there's going to be a film screening. We've got about 2 or 3 minutes left. Just to kind of give us a rundown of what people should expect if they're coming out to the event.
So, yeah, Save the Sound, our partner on this, has created a film. There's also some other American Rivers films that we may be showing that just sort of gives a background about, you know, the benefits of dam removal and why, you know, why we think removing Kennytown Dam makes the most sense. And, you know, staff will be giving a background, you know, giving the general public an understanding of the history of this dam and you know, why we've come to the conclusion that it really does need to be removed. And then, you know, we are going to, you know, reserve most of the meeting really to talk to the community and hear their concerns and try to answer questions that people have. At this point, we're still early on in the process. So, you know, there's a lot of unknowns and
good time to get public input.
You know, we definitely want to hear from the public right now.
All right, Rick, we held the last minute or so for you for
sure.
The last word. Any final thoughts before we say farewell for now?
Yeah, I just want to reiterate that we do want to hear from the community. It's important that they turn out and they tell us you know, we want to hear what they have to say. But by the same token, I want to stress this is an opportunity at this point. You know, this dam facility has all but been abandoned. Mm-hmm. And it is an opportunity at a point in time where the funding is available from the federal government. We have the opportunity to gain control of it and remove what is an environmental hazard from the river. So that's why we're going forward with it now. And just, it's worth noting what we're doing is in response to the Connecticut DEP plan published in 2022, which is to restore diatomaceous fishes to the Naugatuck River watershed. That, you know, we're doing this in response to that plan. It makes the most sense. This is very the good opportunity to get it done. So we want to move forward.
Excellent. So we thank you, Rick Dunn, Executive Director of the Naugatuck Valley Council of Governments, and his colleague, Aaron Budrus, the Environmental Planning Director at the Naugatuck Valley COG. We want you wherever you are in the Naugatuck River, because as you're hearing, there's benefits and detriments to this project, to anywhere you are on or along the river, or if you're just remotely interested because maybe you have a dam on a waterway near you. Come out Wednesday, August 28th, beginning at 6 o'clock to the Ansonia Senior Center, right on the second floor at 65 Main Street. Please register at tinyurl.com/Kinneytown Meeting. Nice and easy to remember. And Rick and Aaron, best of luck with the event and this project as it begins ramping up. I can't wait to talk to you again about it, and I'll be keeping an eye out for you. Thank you so much for being on the program this morning. Well, good morning, folks. This segment this morning puts together a number of things that I really love to do, and that is to try to help inform and educate people about something that they might have heard of but probably don't know a lot about but need to, and to talk about somewhat boutique nonprofit organization with one of its co-founders, and I'm talking about MitoCure. MitoCure.org is their website, and it is a foundation for a cure for mitochondrial disease. It was founded by Bill and Sandy Cunningham. Bill is with us. This happened back in 2000 after their daughter Kelly was diagnosed with mitochondrial disease. Since that time, Kelly's fight with the disease has sadly ended. We lost her in 2005. But not wanting other parents to experience the same heartache, Bill and Sandy remain committed to finding a cure for mitochondrial disease through the work of MitoCure. So we're going to talk all about that. If you like the music of the Eagles, we're going to give you an opportunity to not only support MitoCure, but also have a fantastic night out with Eagle Mania, the premier Eagles cover band. So stick around and hear more about that after we tell you about something else that maybe we can give you. If you're associated with a 501c3 nonprofit, our For the People community partners at Impact Fairfield County just announced the next $100,000 grant opportunity for nonprofits that reach under-resourced populations and highlight unmet needs in Fairfield County. The Impact Fairfield County grant will provide restricted funds to develop new programs to enhance, expand, or strengthen existing programs and or improve organizational capacity that advances the nonprofit organization's core mission. So potential applicants are encouraged to attend an applicant information session. That's going to be on September 17th at the Pequot Library in Southport. And they're also encouraged to review the eligibility criteria and frequently asked questions online at impactffc.org/application-process. Maybe something for you guys, Bill, there with the Impact Fairfield County group. But I really appreciate you being here. We are also very pleased to welcome our very special guest, Costa Estiliu. He is a medical researcher and a very close supporter and friend to MitoCure. So welcome to you both. Bill, let's start with you, and I'll shut up. We heard the story. Very sorry for your loss of Kelly, but tell us a little bit more about how you had to learn about mitochondrial disease.
Great. Well, good morning, and thank you on both fronts. Thank you for the condolences to Kelly, but also thank you for giving us some time this morning and to share with so many listeners out there. Really appreciate that opportunity. I'll tell you, so my daughter Kelly was born in 1990. So the first 8.5 years of her life, she lived a normal life. She was a normal, vivacious child. She was involved in dancing. She was involved in soccer. She very active in Girl Scouts and a very good student. And so we got hit out of left field when she was just about 9 years old. She was at a Girl Scout sleepover at the Boston Children's Museum, and we got a call in the middle of the night that she was experiencing seizures. And so that really began our investigation to try to figure out what was wrong with her, because she began having other things, like she wasn't growing at the same pace as other kids. She was starting to have less energy than other children, and then she began having other more significant symptoms. So, you know, thank God for Connecticut Children's Hospital and the genetics department there. They were able to get her diagnosed fairly quickly relative to what most families experience. And so Kelly was diagnosed with MELOS, which is a form of mitochondrial disease, and in 2020, which is the same year that we started the foundation. You know, once we had an understanding of how serious the disease was and what Kelly's ultimate fate was going to be, unless something, you know, could happen in between. And so we put all of our efforts on raising money to fund research. And at the time, there really wasn't a lot of research going on. There wasn't a lot of other nonprofits that we could partner with that were focused on raising money for research. So with the help of a lot of really good friends at work and friends at home, we started the foundation. And that's really how it all began. And over the course of the last, you know, 20 plus years, we've raised close to $7 million for medical research.
Wow, that's fantastic. If I can ask you, Bill, for the benefit of other parents and loved ones and caregivers of young people out there, was the you know, the seizures were the first warning, but you said you know, the loss of energy, was it a sudden drop off after the seizures? And also in regards to the slower growth, she was on just a normal trajectory of growth according to your pediatrician, and then all of a sudden you know, things just stopped over the course of the you know, year or so after the seizures started.
So I would say that, you know, you all probably remember the graph that the pediatrician would show you
in terms of
your child was on the growth scale. So she was on the scale until she was about 7. And then after that, you know, she started coming off the scale a bit. But I'm 5'7". So I was like, okay, maybe she's just going to be, you know, vertically challenged like I am. and we really didn't think much about it. And then when she had the seizure, we took her to a neurologist, and it was really chalked up as just normal childhood seizure. She'll probably, you know, grow out of it. They did an EKG or an EEG and didn't find anything remarkable that would lead us to any other investigation. Then she had other seizures, and between the two seizures, I would say every couple of months she would vomit and talk about having headaches. Mm. And so we started putting two and two together. You know, she was vomiting more frequently than a child should. She didn't have as much of an appetite, and there was only certain things that she would eat. Mm. And then when she had the other seizure, we brought her back to a neurologist, and then right after that, she had another seizure where she actually lost her eyesight temporarily. Mm. And then, you know, she had an MRI, and what they found was that she had lesions on her brain that were caused by a lack of energy to the brain, which that really prompted the genetic research. But I would say the lack of energy would really be, you know, going to gym class, you know, everybody would run the mile, and she wouldn't be able to finish a quarter mile.
I see.
Going to soccer practice and just not being the same kid out there that she was. You know, at one time not wanting to be the kid on the bench to the kid that was okay being on the bench and watching everybody else play.
So it was
those types of things.
Yeah, and I'm sorry to put you through the recollection, but you did say part of your mission and Sandy's mission is to help educate others, about the condition. And as much as all parents want the best for their kids, one thing that a lot of parents do is, they try not to worry about the worst case scenarios. And, for people to be fully informed, eyes wide open ahead of the game or early on when they start seeing these symptoms, I think retelling some of these more unpleasant details of what you guys went through might be helpful for other parents. So I think it serves a great purpose, and I really appreciate it.
Absolutely, please. Not at all. Yeah. Go ahead.
So let's give you a break, actually, and talk to to Costa. Costa, can I tap you, please, to articulate to all the folks that are listening and to help remind me, what is mitochondrial disease?
Well, as Bill described, it's a disease that affects Almost all the organs in the body, especially the energy-demanding organs, the brain, the vision, auditory, heart, skeletal muscle. So these areas are affected due to not having sufficient energy for the cells to function their responsibilities or carry out their responsibilities. The disease is very problematic in that, as Bill described, the primary mitochondrial diseases are genetic in origin, and they are basically transmitted by the mother to the offspring. So all the mitochondria in our body, the cells in our body, are derived from the very initial mitochondria our mothers gave us. And unlike the nucleus that has one copy each of the mother's genetic code and the father's genetic code, the mitochondria has multiple copies of a separate code, DNA, much smaller. All right. The nuclear genome is about 3.5 billion base pairs, whereas the mitochondrial genome is about 16,500 base pairs. And most people in normal births have one copy or one sequence of base pairs in their mitochondrial DNA. In some cases, very rare cases, about 1 in 4,000 to 5,000 live births, there is a mutated form of mitochondrial DNA that is passed along with the normal mitochondrial DNA, a condition that is called heteroplasmy. So it's heterogeneous in terms of the sequences. The normal mitochondria DNA produces the energy, among many other things that it does, but primarily mitochondria produce the energy, and everything that the cell does requires energy. And of course, the most energy demanding cells in our body are those involved in vision, photoreceptor cells, which explains partly the problem that Kelly had with her vision, and the brain, which explains the seizures.
So it sounds to me like it's the gas that runs the cells, the motors of the cells.
Yeah, if you want to put it that way.
Yeah.
My mitochondria are little furnaces.
I see.
And the more active the furnace is, the more opportunity it has for failure.
Mm-hmm.
It basically self-destructs. And that's been built in by nature to replace broken down, if you will, furnace repairs. And that is done when the mitochondrial DNA given to us mainly by our mother, it's not the only DNA that causes problems. The nuclear DNA contributes also. Mm-hmm. But let's focus on just this mitochondrial DNA, which is the predominant molecule that causes the injury, if you will.
Yeah.
When there's not sufficient energy to carry out the functions of the cell which is does the job that it requires to do. So, for example, in the brain to provide synapses and other functions, carrying out oxygen to the brain and so on. As we all know, the brain is about 2% of the body weight, but it eats up more than 20% of the oxygen. Wow. The reason for that is oxygen is required to burn the fuel.
Mm-hmm.
And the burning of the fuel, food that we eat, is done in the mitochondria. So we breathe in oxygen, and the mitochondria convert the food that we eat using this oxygen into energy called adenosine triphosphate, or okay. ATP, as most people probably know that mm-hmm. from their elementary or high school biology classes. And that energy then powers everything the cell needs to do. And when that energy becomes or decreases unexpectedly, there are many functions that are vital to the life of the cell that are not completed. So it may be producing, let's say, a protein. It runs short on energy and then stops producing the protein because it doesn't have the fuel or the energy right. to complete the job. Okay. So,
yeah, and just to interject for a second, yeah. and as you think about Kelly, it started in her, you know, seizures and brain symptoms, but obviously it affects other organs as well. And in yeah. her case, her entire body was affected by it. So yeah. she had, issues in every organ, and ultimately lost her vision, lost her hearing,
yeah.
lost her ability to speak, and basically, you know, ultimately her heart and lungs stopped functioning, and, yeah. and she died.
So Costa, what is the degree of hopefulness that you have today based on your colleagues and the research that you're doing and you're familiar with in terms of progress toward a cure?
Well, on the bright side, there's a lot more that's being done today than it was when Bill started the foundation. And this can be also evident in the number of clinics that are being opened or sprouting in major hospitals that are dedicated to mitochondrial disease. Here in Boston, we have the Boston Children's Hospital, mm-hmm. the Massachusetts General Hospital. There's a clinic called Mito Clinic dedicated to mitochondrial disease. There's one famous one also in Philadelphia, the Children's Hospital there sure. in Cleveland. Almost all the hospitals, all the major hospitals have now recognized that attention needs to focus on mitochondria for not only the mitochondrial diseases, but because they are so-called power-forming cells, powerhouses of the cell, diseases like diabetes, of course, the neurodegenerative diseases, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's disease, as we said, vision loss and so on. All of these are high energy type of cells that are involved in these diseases, either directly, as in mitochondrial disease, or in indirectly.
Okay.
In our research, so go ahead.
No. I we've got about 3 or 4 minutes left, and I want to make sure we're able to invite our listeners to this event, because I think we're getting the idea that just in a few short years, there's been a proliferation of research being done by the top players in your game. if I gather correctly. So the hope toward a cure and the concentration of great minds like your own working toward that cure, it really requires, if you will, the fuel of funding to be able to get to the goal, which is the endpoint of the research where cures are being developed. So let me revert back to Bill, because Bill, you've already been able to generate millions for research toward this end, and you're hearing now and probably know the progress that's being made. So let's get some folks out to get to know you and Sandy and your team at MitoCure while having a little fun and enjoying some really, really popular music with Eagle Mania. What's this event coming up in late September over in Prospect, Connecticut?
Great, thanks. Yes, September 26th. We figured on a Thursday afternoon in September, folks might want to stroll out of work a little early.
Sorry, is it
show 20, up and begin
28, 26?
September 26th. September 26th.
Okay.
Thursday at 4 o'clock at Holiday Hill in Prospect, Connecticut. And folks can go on our website, mitocure.org, and pull up all the details. But it's an event where you'll be eating from four to nine. The band will go on around 6:30, and it is just a beautiful venue. I'm assuming a lot of folks on this that are listening to this have either seen or heard of Holiday Hill before. It's a beautiful 200-plus acre facility, and it'll be serving beer and wine and soft drinks. Children under 13. It's $50 for adults. It's $100, and I think there's an $8 charge for the transaction fee for the software that we use.
Mm.
But really, for $100, you're going to listen to a great band, and we'll have raffles and other fun events going on that evening as well. And hopefully, we can see as many folks out there that want to be part of it. We shifted to this event. We've done 20 plus golf tournaments, and we pivoted and decided to go to a new venue to try to attract more of the community, more non-golfers, if you will, and more families to come and experience and listen to what we're having, what we're raising money for and having some fun along the way.
Well, that's great. Well, I appreciate your energy. And once again, I'm so sorry for your and Sandy's loss, but the experience, as it has been in the case with so many folks who've come on our program, is, taking their own personal tragedy and finding inspiration in it to ensure that others do not have to go through it. And it sounds from what Costa is explaining that there are a lot of great minds working toward that end. So we hope folks can come out. All you need to do to get started to learn more about this organization, maybe make a donation if you can't come out to their event, is to go to MitoCure, MitoCure.org. And we hope you do come out to Holiday Hill and Prospect on September 26th to support this important cause. So we'll say farewell for now. Bill Cunningham, co-founder of MitoCure, and Costa Stiliu, who's been kind enough to join us from Boston, where he's a professor and medical researcher, and obviously very, very much in tune to everything related to mitochondrial disease. Costa, thank you so much. And Bill, best of luck. We'll talk to you again soon.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a PSA for our program that's relevant to the audiences and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to john.vocat@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program can be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station websites. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette.
I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime. Just find it under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.